Hey folks, this is Simon Ward. Welcome to the High Performance Human Podcast. It's time for another episode where we are devoted to helping you achieve optimal human performance. Please check out my website, simonwardtriathloncoach.com, for all my latest blogs and send your questions to beth@thetriathloncoach.com. If you're not already a subscriber to the show, please go to simonward.podbean.com, where you can subscribe and make sure you don't miss any of our weekly episodes. Hello, listeners. Well, I'm so excited today because my guest this morning is Dr. Stephen Seiler, all the way from Norway. And if you can recall in some of the pre-show notes that I put out on Facebook, Dr. Seiler is, in fact, our second most popular guest ever. He's catching up with Phil Maffetone, but that Phil Maffetone was on the show a bit before him, so he had a head start in terms of number of listens. But Stephen, thanks very much for coming back onto the show. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. It's a pleasure.
It's been a strange few months since we last spoke, hasn't it? I think our previous conversation was just after Christmas. So it seems like the world's been turned upside down since then.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right. This was our last interview was pre-lockdown, pre-COVID. So a tremendous amount of stuff has happened. And I guess some things have not happened because of what we've experienced. So both have been, for me, impactful, both the new things and the things lost.
What's just briefly on a sort of like a, you know, a general scale, what's changed about your life in Norway then in the last few months?
Well, I was this year was a particularly heavy travel year for me. I was gonna, because I had a sabbatical, and so I just had a, I was able to say yes to a lot of invitations to travel and speak around the world. So I was lined up to give a lot of lectures in different countries, Europe, you know, Asia and so forth. And all of that just went away. I mean, I was busy from October to February and then suddenly it was zero. And so now since March, I've been working from home, you know, trying to make myself useful, but also trying to adjust, you know, some advising of students and PhD students and, you know, did some lectures in the form of webinars. And, you know, so I think we've all, a lot of us who do this stuff have been trying to figure out how to make it work in a digital environment.
And we were talking just before we pressed the record button there about all of that travel. Clearly your credit card will have been breathing a sigh of relief this year, like most people's, and your bank balance will probably look a bit healthier. But does the lack of travel sort of fill you with any deal of sadness, or are you, because, you know, whilst it's great to get out and meet people and be in front of people and sit and chat and over lunch and over a beer, it takes its toll on you, doesn't it? A lot of global travel, time zone changes, and you'll know this as a scientist.
Yeah, it does. And I do. It's kind of like my version of competition. You know, it's what gives me a, adrenaline kick to get up in front of the audience and try to do a good job. But it is just like those competitions, after they're over, you often get kind of almost a post-traumatic stress. You know, you really are used up, and I find, you know, that I have to recover. So these trips, yeah, they are fun. They are turbo tourism and that, but then they do come at a cost. So I have to say, some of that, you know, I've probably been healthier. I've been more at peace. I've been more rested. My stress level has been lower, all of those things in the last 4 months, because I've been fortunate. My job hasn't been in danger. You know, I have tremendous respect for many people who have experienced this period as an extremely high stress situation. But for me, just because I happen to have a job where that job wasn't going to go away because of Corona or COVID-19, I've actually cut my stress down. I've made a garden. I've been able to coach my daughter more, kind of, you know, face to face. Enjoy that, and so there's been actually for me some benefits and some recalibration, I suppose, and realizing that, you know what, you don't need to travel all over the world. It's not the only, there's other ways to disseminate knowledge.
Hmm. I sent you some quick fire questions, and the first one I'd asked you was what superpower to have, and I've asked this quite a few times recently to other guests, and one of the things was the ability to compress time so that you could travel to Australia and just like walking into a door in through one door and out the other side without all of the sort of the hassle of flying and traveling in between.
Yeah, you know, and I was thinking about some really, you know, some really cool superpowers, but I decided to just choose that one that wasn't that super, that was somewhat marginally more realistic, and it was related to just thoughts I've been doing on research and load and stress with training and that. And so my superpower that I wished for was like no or unlimited buffering of hydrogen ions and unlimited quickness of recovery of creatine phosphate so that I could experience what it's like, what it'd be like to be able to just do lots of these really hard surges during cycling races and just not be affected by it. So that was my, it's a superpower that perhaps some of the elite cyclists almost have, but that I do not. And I just wanted to have fun with that for a few weeks.
And I can understand why you'd want that. You've been doing an awful lot of Zwift racing during the last few months.
Yeah, that's right. And so that's my new, you know, thing is I think, well, if I can improve that ability to recover on the fly, and as I do get a bit better at it, then my kind of my position in the rankings goes up. And, you know, I follow that now. It's a curse and a blessing, but it's fun. So they have these rankings called Zwift Power, and you can, and if you choose, like I now am in the super competitive 50 to 59 year, 80 to 89 kilo group. So I both use age and weight to my advantage.
I think you have to use everything on there. I've still not, and it's almost like a resistance to it now. In the same way that I've resisted watching Star Wars movies, I've resisted going on Zwift. I managed to resist Game of Thrones for quite some time, but I've eventually succumbed to that one. But that ability to recover quickly. I remember when Contador was racing, you'd see him sprint up the road and then they'd catch him and then he'd do it again and they'd catch him and you think, well, how long can he keep doing this? But he just never seemed to tire, did he? It was just a matter of keeping going until everybody had cracked.
Yeah, that's right. Keep stretching the rubber band until it snaps. And so it's a fascinating, and some, you know, I joke about it, but we'll get into this perhaps as we move forward, but I, some conceptualizations of durability and high intensity repeatability, those are issues that I'm trying to understand as a scientist, and also, you know, how the training process impacts that, and you know, things that we don't necessarily measure very well right now in typical laboratory testing, but that, you know, that are relevant, that ability to repeatedly do those surges and come back. That's not something we capture with normal testing. So this all kind of, you know, it all hangs together for me, my hobby and my science and my, you know, my avocation and my vocation often melt together. So
I recall when Paula Radcliffe was racing, she was great if you could just set her off and let her go at the same pace and wind it up slowly. But where she used to fall down was when the Kenyans and the other East African athletes would surge and then come back and surge, and she couldn't match that. And I suppose if I'm thinking of cyclists, Miguel Indurain was very similar to that. He would just ride at this steady tempo and know that once the other guys had attacked, he could slowly reel them in. But if they really did put down quick bursts of power,
Yeah, but Indurain, you know, Indurain had a monstrous basic VO2, you know, his maximum VO2, his function, if there had been a functional threshold power in his day, it would have been, you know, he could just sit on that and basically wear everybody else out. Whereas we see the same in cross-country skiing. If we go back to the 90s, 80s, 90s, and some of the great Norwegian or Scandinavian athletes there, they just had these huge engines. Bjørn Dalen had 7 liters, you know, and that's what they would do, is just take off hard and just slowly everyone else would disintegrate. Whereas today, cross country skiing is more like cycling, and cycling, you know, they're playing these cat and attacking and so forth in a different way that uses up the athlete in a different way and forces them to train differently. So some of our super, some of those Indurain types or Bjørn Dalen types with the big engine, but pretty limited, you know, not that same kind of, what do you want to call it? Anaerobic recovery capacity. They either would have had to adapt to this new world, or maybe they wouldn't have been the superstars they are. They were then. I'm not sure which is the case, but you know, to some extent, they would have adapted. But it's an interesting development.
We should come back to that maybe and talk about whether that's whether that's human adaptation or just a training process, you know, nature or nurture.
Yeah, and at least in some sports, it's been driven by television, you know, because the governing bodies of these sports have tried to make them more exciting, more interesting. So they've changed race formats, they've changed the distance, you know, the stages are shorter, the races are shorter, there are more fluctuations. And so some of this is just a function of the fact that television decides, you know.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. There's a lot of things that all work together on this. But one thing's for sure that I've seen is athletes adapt. If it's possible to adapt, if it's possible to adjust your training, to adjust your technique, adjust your strategy, they do it pretty darn quickly.
Yeah, I think I used to work in professional cricket as a fitness conditioner. And back then, 10 or 15 years ago, we had one day, I don't know what you know of cricket. It's sort of like baseball on Valium, really.
Yeah.
We used to have a one-day match, which was 50 overs. So each team would bat for 3 or 4 hours generally, and then the other team would bat. But now we have this thing called 2020, where basically it's smash and grab from the moment the players come in, and you know it's non-stop, and the players have to have a different sort of fitness to be able to sprint between the wickets and then recover and face the next ball. And when you're facing a guy bowling at 90 miles an hour, and you're still got a heart rate of 150. That's a lot harder to deal with than if you're very composed.
Right.
So, yeah. And that's purely been driven by TV. And of course, the players have had to adapt. And those there are players now who are specialists at that sort of game, but don't play, would perhaps not be picked to play in a 5-day test match versus Australia or the West Indies.
Right. And you have rugby sevens, which were started in the Olympics in Rio, which I watched and loved. Mm-hmm. And that's the same kind of situation that, you know, the purists probably think it's a bastardization, but it's for us that are not rugby purists, we think it's pretty cool.
Mm. Listen, I've got quite a few quickfire questions to ask you, Stephen, but we're moving on with this conversation. So one of the most popular questions I've asked, and this is I'd like to get something from you on this one, is about books you read. So what was the last I can see in your on your the wall behind you in your bookcase there's an awful lot of books. I can't make them out, but what was the last book that you read?
Well, I'm finishing up right now a biography called Leonardo da Vinci by Walter Isaacson, and it's for me a fantastic book. I've seen some of the great works of da Vinci, both, you know, sketches and the Mona Lisa, and but he is to me one of the most amazing minds that has ever been documented, I guess we can say, or that we know about. And so I found it to be a wonderful book, and I can absolutely recommend it. And Walter Isaacson is a tremendous biographer.
Oh, well, that's a different slant on what we normally get. But one thing that always resonates with me is when you read about high-performing humans, regardless of the particular field that they performed highly in, there are certain traits that come out. So you would see and read things, and particularly as somebody who studies sport and the mind of athletes and the way they sort of set their lives up, you would note particular traits in Leonardo da Vinci that you might also note in an Olympic athlete, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, he was just, you know, da Vinci was inexhaustibly curious. And took copious notes. He wasn't a very good publisher, so he didn't function well. He would have never functioned well in the traditional academic environment, or maybe he would have if he'd had team members around him that would have helped to transcribe all of this amazing brain power into production, but he had an incredible ability to, you know, he wasn't a trained mathematician, but he would use comparison, analogy, you know, so he could compare the human heart and the cardiovascular system with a plant and how it emerged from a seed, or he could look at water and pumps and compare with blood flow. And, you know, so he just had this, he used analogy in his way of trying to understand the world. And he achieved a tremendous amount with that approach. And I still think that's, you know, it's interesting because he connected things instead of trying to put them in different boxes. As scientists today, we tend to get very, you know, we get into our little specific box, our sandbox, and we can't play with anybody else. Whereas he just crossed all of these divides, art, music, you know, engineering, anatomy. And so I think that's what I find just amazing.
Yeah. And talking of, you know, the circulation of the blood and comparing that to plants, he did that at a time when we didn't have the insight into the human body that we have now.
Oh, I mean, yeah, if he had published his dissection, you know, and he was the most amazing artist. So his drawings of the human body were still today some of the best ever. But he never really published it as a authoritative anatomical compendium. Had he done that, he would have helped to get rid of some crazy ideas and misunderstandings about anatomy that were perpetuated by guys like Galen for hundreds of years. He was so far ahead of his time. He actually described atherosclerosis, arteriosclerosis, in his anatomical dissections, you know, and so he got that right. He showed, oh, this is part of the aging process, that inside these arteries, there is a, you know, a calcification going on, or there. And so he describes all this 500 years ago. But then he would move on to the next thing. You know, he would want to know how the tongue of the woodpecker works, or, you know, and so he was just, he had this amazing curiosity, but maybe what he didn't have was the goal-getter finishing power. You know, that's maybe was his, I think if he'd had that, it's almost scary to think how much he would have changed the world.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it Da Vinci that drew the first diagrams of helicopters many, many years before they were invented?
Nope. He did. He drew diagrams of helicopters. He drew, you know, water systems for draining swamps. I mean, his engineering, he did all this military stuff design wise, but he didn't really like war. He didn't, you know, he thought it was brutal, but he needed to make money. He needed to, so he would ingratiate himself to these various kings or whoever they were, and he would make himself useful by proposing engineering ideas that usually didn't ever come to fruition, but that would allow him to also do all the other stuff he wanted to do. So he did figure out how to play that game a bit, you know, but it sometimes he would find himself at odds with his own morals, his own moral compass, and then he would try to extract himself from the situation, you know, in terms of the military part. Anyway, so it's a great book. I can recommend it. You know, I just find him to be, I love, you know, today in the age of specialization that we are off in science and academia and so forth, I still have a certain appreciation for the crossover capacity, the ability to kind of link different fields and draw knowledge in from outside your own special interest area. And coaches, I think, are a bit like that. They, good coaches kind of are part physiologist, part psychologist, part physicist. And, you know, and so we all, if you want to be a good coach, you kind of need to be a Renaissance person, and handle that appropriately, you know, that interaction with different fields, without losing yourself. So,
Well, and the thing that you mentioned right at the beginning that, that you admired about Da Vinci was inexhaustibly curious, were your words. And I think that the good coaches that I've met have inexhaustible curiosity about things, which helps them get to the position they're in.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think when you stop being curious, you need to get out of the game, either as a coach or as a professor or whatever. I've always said that, man. When I, if you find me that I'm shuffling the same papers and that, get rid of me, put me out of my misery.
Mm. Well, let's talk about some of the things that have happened in the intervening period, Stephen. You're very prominent on Twitter. You drop a few grenades in there and create some great discussions. One of the things you talk about on Twitter, and I recall seeing a little post you did the other day comparing, it's about your daughter's training. Your daughter's turning herself into a pretty decent, is she a middle distance runner?
No, she doesn't have a middle distance gene in her body as far as I can tell, but she's more of a distance. So it's more, yeah, lower end will probably be 5K and best distance for her currently is probably half marathon.
Okay, so you'd posted about her ability to do some high intensity intervals to maintain the pace and to actually do more of them, I think, in comparison to what she was able to do this time last year. And
yeah,
really,
I just posted that yesterday. It was just one of the classic interval sessions for, let's, you know, your 5K, 10K types would be a 10 times 1,000 meter. And so she's done that a few times. And the issue was back a year ago, which I've also talked about, was that when she would do interval sessions, she would just do them too hard. In other words, she would race every hit session as if she didn't do a personal best, it was a failure. And that ended up putting her in a situation where she didn't recover. She actually kind of pushed herself too far, got overreached. And then when she did have races for a while there last year, her race performance wasn't as good as it could have been, should have been. So we had to kind of recalibrate and find, as she has said now, she just says it in her head, 90%, 90%, 90%. You know, so she tells herself to keep herself at that 90% level. And that gives her a sustainable, it's a good stimuli. She gets better, but it's also she recovers from it. And so I just showed an example where now she was able to do 10 times 1,000 meters at a speed that represents probably her at 34:30 for 10K. And now it's reasonable. And her blood lactate was 5 millimolar. Her heart rate was still 10, 11 beats below max heart rate at the end of the workout. And she wasn't destroyed by the session. She could get up the next morning and run again. And that's that sustainability issue. Whereas the year before that same workout, she was running it way harder than her actual capacity indicated. She was at max heart rate at the end. It was basically, she was at the end of a 10K race and it was too tough for her. That wasn't sustainable. So that's the example I was trying to show.
So it's interesting to me and probably to a lot of listeners that what you're saying is, even though it's an HIT session, and I think you've coined this phrase, you need to have some intensity discipline. It's not about going as hard as you can for that session. You need to do enough to create the stimuli, but also make sure you don't do too much that it compromises future training sessions, because as you were, you know, very fond of saying, and correctly so, it's about consistency. It's about putting all the bricks in the wall. It's not about just getting one hero session. Returning to the conversation about your daughter's 10 times 1K intervals, I think it's a commonly held misconception among athletes that when you're doing a HIT session, that you have to go as hard as possible. And I know Jack Daniels, the running coach, talks about this, where, you know, there's a certain effort level you need to put in to get the stimuli. And then there's a dead zone above that. And at that point, then you need to go on to the next level. So it's like, this is threshold, that's VO2 max. And if you go too hard, you're straying from one defined goal set into another. So, and that seems to be what you're saying here, is that your daughter had this idea that she should just go as hard as she could on these. She couldn't complete the whole set, and it destroyed her for subsequent sessions, so it took her longer to recover.
Yeah, and I, this isn't my invention. This is just one of these things I've seen with other really great athletes, is that they seem to, over time, discover that, you know, in a five-zone intensity model, for example, where zone four and five are both above the so-called anaerobic threshold or maximum lactate steady state, they tend to do a lot more work in zone four and less work in zone five. Even if they race in zone five, they don't need to go there very often in training. I guess that's the wisdom that emerges. And that wisdom, as I've seen it in top rowers, I've seen it in top cyclists, you know, guys like Cadel Evans that, you know, would not do some of these incredible interval sessions that the younger guys were pushing themselves through. And then the younger guys would say, why don't you do this? And, you know, Cadel would say, well, it's a long season, my man. And, you know, I've got to think about the longer, you know, the bigger picture of getting myself ready for the tour. So I have to choose my battles. So these kinds of examples have come from multiple sports and multiple athletes. And my daughter went through the exact same learning experience. She had to go over that edge to learn and then pull herself back. And now, you know, she understands her own body better. And her overall training, she's in a better flow and has fewer bad days. So that's part of the process, part of the learning process.
You talk about zone four and zone five there, and there are so many different presentations of training zones that it's easy to become confused. In your mind, how would you define zone four for our listeners, and how would you define zone five? Just before you answer for me, that would be zone four would be just above the second turn point or anaerobic threshold, and zone five would be VO2 max. Is that how you define it?
Yeah, it's pretty close. You know, there's no clear cut physiological marker where you can say, now we've gone into zone five. You know, you can identify these break points with lactate to go from three to four, like you're saying, that threshold that moves you into that zone four, that you can find in the lab, and there's different ways of finding it and defining it. But then we tend to just arbitrarily take that the space or the intensity range from second lactate turn point to VO2 max. We often divide that in two, so that maybe for most people it might be 86-87% of heart rate max up to 92% or so, 93 maybe is zone four, and then 92.3 up to VO2 max or 100% of heart rate max, that's zone five. So when you get into zone five, you're pushing on all cylinders, and usually you're not there without also carrying with you a pretty high blood lactate concentration.
So Stephen, just to clarify then, zone four would be just above the second turn point or that anaerobic threshold, roughly, because it'll depend who the person is, 87 to 92% of maximum heart rate. And zone five then is the next level up, which we commonly know as VO2 max, which would be 92 to 100% of maximum heart rate. Is that what you said?
Yeah, that's a fairly, you know, that's a good rule of thumb. You know, we're always sensitive to the individual aspects of it, but that for well-trained people, that is a pretty decent guesstimation without putting them in the lab. And the main point is there is no clear-cut distinction zone four versus zone five. So it seems to be a good pedagogical tool to kind of divide up that zone into two. And often a little bit depending on how people are put together and how they're trained and so forth, at least often people find that it's tougher to come back from those sessions if there's a lot of zone five. If they've really built, you know, had really high blood lactate, if they've really been up there, you know, maybe the cortisol response is really, at least for my daughter, if she has a big zone five contribution in an interval session, she needs 3 days to recover. If she stays in zone four, she only needs 2 days. So it cuts 24 hours off her recovery time. And I mean, if she needed to actually go hard again, that's the way I look at recovery. If she were going to go hard again, repeat that session, how long would it take her? And it cuts 24 hours off the recovery time if she avoids going in zone five, you know, too much at all. So that's that sustainability issue. Now, there may be times when you need to go into zone five. You need to do that in a race prep. Don't get me wrong. But at least in that day in, day out over the long haul, what we see is that a lot of, or at least most of the elite performers that I've looked at, they tend to aggregate their HIIT training in that zone four area.
Okay. And zone four then, because it's a slightly lower intensity, the interval durations would be longer. I mean, if your daughter's, I think, referencing that example that we talked about on Twitter, those 1K reps are around 325, 326.
Yeah. And so the key, and this is a really good transition into the main, you know, if we start talking about putting together an interval session and what are the key variables, the key variable, or at least one of the two or three key variables of an interval session, is total accumulated work duration. So when you're as a coach, you know that if you set up a workout where the total accumulated duration is going to be, say, 15 minutes, you know, that let's say four times four, well, they're going to have a much higher intensity than if you say, today, boys and girls, it's 5 times 8 minutes. That's 40 minutes of accumulated work. Well, that's going to kind of move them into a different intensity zone. When you say, I want it at a hard pace, 5 times 8 minutes, and I want you even, I don't want you to fly and die. Well, you've kind of given them an equation and told them to solve it. And so total accumulated duration is important. And then, of course, the next part of that is what is the size of the Lego blocks we're adding together? Are they 8 minute intervals, 6 minute intervals, or in the case of this 12 times 1,000 meter, is it about 3.5 minutes? Well, that also, of course, impacts the intensity that the athlete works at. So those two are really important. And then, of course, the third variable is recovery duration. But that is surprisingly, for many, it's not as critical as you might think. In other words, the range of recoveries, once you get above, say, 60, 90 seconds, all the way up to, say, 5 minutes of recovery, doesn't have as much impact as you might think on the sustainable intensity. You know, so that's why I often just say 2 or 3 minutes of recovery time is enough. And you don't need to be thinking too complicated about, well, should it be 60, 75, a minute, 20, 2 to 10, you know, just give them 2 minutes and then go again. And it usually is going to be okay.
A lot of our listeners, Stephen, will be of an older age group. I mean, you mentioned earlier your Zwift age group's 50 to 59. Do you think that recovery and attention to recovery is more important for older athletes, and that actually stretching out that recovery is more beneficial so that the individual can actually get better quality out of the work bout?
Well, I guess I have to make sure we're talking on which recovery. Are we talking about recovery time between work bouts of an interval session, or are we talking about recovery after an interval session?
Initially I'm talking about the recovery in between efforts. So if you've got those four or five times 8 minutes, the recovery between the 8 minute efforts, should it be longer? Could it be longer? Does it matter for older athletes?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I don't think so. Not really. I mean, I think the basic physiology there is going to be the same, but where the difference will be is that older athlete will probably just have a lower pace or power output during the work bout. But the basic recovery of creating phosphate, getting rid of hydrogen ions, those kinds of physiological processes, I don't think, you know, that well-trained age grouper is qualitatively different from the themselves at 30 years old. The what we see with the muscle adaptations in that, they're basically the same. So I wouldn't do things fundamentally differently as a coach for the for a 55-year-old versus a 25-year-old. Where I think where the age gets us is how long we're going to need to recover after the hit session. You know, when are we going to be ready to fire up a new hit session? It may be that our recovery has slowed down and we need 3 days to recover instead of two.
I think Ned Overend, the I don't know if you're familiar with Ned. He was a mountain bike racer. I think he did some Ex-Terra triathlons. He's done some books in collaboration with Joe Friel. Fast After 50, I think, was the one. And in there, he writes, I can at 60, whatever he is now, 62, 63, I can still do the same training that I did when I was 30. I just need a few more days to fit it all in. So it would have what would have been a 7-day training block is now a 10-day training block because he needs to have more recovery days in between those hard efforts.
So, yeah, well, that sounds exactly right in my book, and it sounds consistent with what I experience with my own body. But I should say that I think a lot of young athletes are also, despite their youth and their better recovery ability, they're also trying to squeeze too much hard work into 7 days. I can exemplify that with my daughter at age 22. She is training and having a much better overall training process once we extended her cycle to 9 days. It was 10, now it's 9, but we had to stretch it a little bit from 7 because 7 just wasn't working. And so we added a couple of days and it gives her a bit more breathing room, a couple of extra easy sessions between the harder sessions, and everything just is flowing better for her as an athlete. So I don't think that's just an issue for the 50-plus athletes that are listening, but it can also be a big issue for the younger athletes because they think they're indestructible and they think they can just go hard, you know, really often. But they may also find that's they're actually overreaching a bit. They just don't realize it because it's chronic.
Paula Radcliffe used to do an 8-day training block. And I always wondered, and I guess it's different for different coaches, but in the example here that you're given with your daughter, do you start out with a blank sheet of paper and say, these are the training sessions that we need to accomplish in this training block, and then work out how many days that you're going to need to accomplish that, and hence you've arrived at that 9-day cycle instead of 7 days?
Yeah, that's kind of the way it has worked. You know that I tend to be kind of polarized in my approach. So when my daughter is not doing a high intensity session, then she's running at low intensity. So she does train quite polarized. The data shows that about 86-87% of her time in zone is below her first lactate turn point. About 10% total is either zone 4 or zone 5. And then a little bit in the middle in zone 3. So she does train, I guess you would say, quite polarized, but we do have, in her mind, what makes her nervous are these big sessions. So we're very careful to kind of anchor those and say, well, one of those is going to be, for example, right now, the last couple of cycles, one of those is a bit longer interval session, and another one is more of a, for her, more of a track speed session. And then she has a long run, but it's not at high intensity, but it's just a bit longer. So those are the three workouts that are kind of stretched out in that 9-day cycle. And then everything in between is just low intensity running. It's just, 15K in zone 1 for her, 120 heart rate, 125. And those she just handles really easily. She just loves them. But she has three workouts that are either intensive or extensively stretched. And basically she's either got 2 or 3 days of low intensity between each of those. Or a rest day.
And how do you work out you know, how much of that other low intensity stuff she's doing, then is that on a weekly or a mileage or a duration type basis?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, that's been trial and error. And of course, it's partly an adaptation process, because we do feel like over time that the training volume needs to increase, but only as she absorbs it, you know, and that, so it's a slow deal. And now she's at a point where she absorbs, handles, say, 120 to 130 kilometer weeks pretty well, pretty consistently. It's not, it's smooth, and she's not having any unexpected issues, as long as she keeps easy, you know, and doesn't, you know, it doesn't take very much to mess it up. Like, for example, a few weeks ago, she did a run with a sponsor, you know, a guy, and she said that, you know, I was talking the whole way and he was running a bit faster and they ran a bit long and a bit hard. And then suddenly, so her easy day that day turned into kind of like a threshold session. And not a big deal, but she felt it a little bit, because now she's, you know, her rhythm was a bit off. And so she didn't quite feel right for the next HIIT session. So these are the things, that discipline, that intensity discipline, ends up being pretty important when your athlete is kind of, you know, they're hovering right around what they sustainably tolerate. So that's how they have to be a bit cognizant of these little issues. If they accidentally train harder, or, you know, that's okay, but they need to just work that in and adjust for it in the subsequent days.
Dude, on top of all of the running that you talk about there, does she do any formal gym training, some strength training to help her build a more robust body in order to absorb this training more?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's really important. At least we feel like it is. She happens to have a background in dance. So she did a lot of strength training, a lot of core training, as they call it, as a dancer. And I think some of that is carried over for her in terms of posturally and that. She hasn't had any injury issues really to speak of at all. But the one thing is strength training just to kind of maintain technical posture. And then the second level is strength training because we think it can actually increase stride length. In other words, at a given stride frequency, that she gets a better horizontal power, because that's ultimately what is going to make her faster, is more centimeters in each stride adds up to faster lap times. But that's got to be, she's got to be able to handle it metabolically. So there's a slow, you know, we're doing strength training. She does pistols, one-legged squats, regular squats, also some jumps and so forth for tendon stiffness. So we do try to, you know, and that's just a long-term project. So the strength training is always there in the background. But then sometimes you ease up on it because, you know, we don't want her sore for races and so forth. But it's a long-term project where certain points of the year, or like early season, preseason, there'll be more strength training to try to fill that gap and build her body towards the future, you know, which is to say, you know, she's a 34 10K runner now, and if she has any aspirations of being faster, you know, being significantly faster, we don't think that's going to happen without also more hip power, more butt muscle, to just say the harsh reality about it, because that's, you know, part of going faster is just having that power.
So, we had a question from a listener that says, does strength training fit with polarized training? My interpretation of polarized training is it's very much based around the sort of metabolic system, you know, heart rates and effort levels, which would be more relevant to what we consider to be aerobic training, whereas strength training is a different type of thing. It's about connective tissue and about rate of force development. However, it seems to me that a polarized training program would be far more effective with the addition of some formal strength training, which starts off with just building the muscle, and then transitions into some very specific plyometric type work, which then develops the power that you talk of to increase stride length.
Yeah, I guess that's the way I see the strength training. And I do have some background in strength training. That's kind of where I started. But the first thing that endurance athletes can benefit from strength training is just to correct small weaknesses, small Achilles heels. Sometimes it can even be the actual Achilles. But you know what I'm saying, that to correct these small issues, core issues or so forth, that will tend to increase their likelihood of injuries, of overuse injuries. So that's just a sustainability issue, is improving the basic armor, the structure of the body, so that it's more durable. And if we do that, then that opens up the possibility to also then take it to the next level and try to say, well, can we change with strength training the stimulus to try to change these tendons, to try to maybe just add a little bit of muscle mass. And we're always careful, you know, we know that an endurance athlete doesn't want to unnecessarily gain weight. So it's always a trade-off, a checks and balances in terms of, you know, what's the advantage of that extra pound of muscle or two versus the disadvantage. And so all of these things are there in our minds. But when I look at good female distance runners in that 5K to 10K space, you know, they have muscles in their hips. They've got a nice solid set of glutes. Mm. And that seems to be necessary. And that's kind of one of the things I've been saying to my daughter is, look, you know, that you gotta have some muscle mass here, my dear, if you're gonna compete at that next level. It's not just about being light. And I think that's almost a refreshing reality to be able to show our female athletes, because of all the issues with body weight and eating issues and so forth, is, look, the best runners in the world, they're not toothpicks. They have muscle in those force generating muscles, the hips, you know? Mm-hmm. So, don't be afraid of that.
Yeah, it's about performance, not fashion, isn't it? When you get to the pointy end of racing, really, and you have to do what's necessary.
Yeah, but you know, we do still face some issues with weight. You know, that people think that if I'm light enough, that I'll be faster, and to a certain extent, there is truth in that, of course, but it's not a if we extend that far enough, you kill yourself. And so that's the message that for me is finding that balance between a robust muscular body and then also that lightness, the springiness, the that we don't have to carry excess weight. So I get it, but it's a tough balance to find. And particularly for female athletes, a lot of female endurance athletes, it pushes them mentally and psychologically to do things that they shouldn't do. So, and my daughter's, that's happened to her. So we're very sensitive about it, you know, the energy in, energy out and all of that. And I guess it's helped me to be even more tuned in to all of these realities, that the complexity of training athletes, you know, and helping them be their best in a healthy way.
Yeah, I have a strength and conditioning background as well, and it's always a difficult selling point to even age group athletes, where I often think it's more important for me working with them to help them become healthier humans first before we focus on their athletic performance, and that strength training and functional strength should be a part of that. But one of the big obstacles in their mind is that, well, if I do this, I'm going to gain weight, because most people seem to associate strength training with the bodybuilding type of approach.
It's unfortunate.
And, there's a lot of athletes in weight restricted categories. You know, you talked about rowing, we can talk about the fighting classes, sports like judo and boxing and wrestling, where athletes are put into different weight categories where it's critical for them to stay under a particular below a particular barrier, but yet they need to be strong and powerful, so they have to engage in strength training to get them the performance levels, but they don't want to be a particular weight, otherwise they end up in the next category. So it's perfectly possible to increase your strength without gaining too much weight, but you just have to do it in a particular way. And that's not the way that tends to appear in the fitness magazines, which is, I think, part of the problem.
Right. And even in these weight restricted, the category type events, there is a trade-off, and there comes a time for some of the athletes that where they perform better by going up a weight class.
Yeah.
And the lightweight rower performs better. In fact, in rowing, we're going to see the end of lightweight rowing because of the Olympics and the World Championships removing those categories. So that's a whole nother topic, is you're going to see a lot of amazing 70 kilo rowers that can gain 10 kilos and compete as kind of lightish heavyweights, but they move boats really, really well. And so, you know, these barriers are coming down, and it's always a checks and balances, a trade-off, you know, the advantages of being a bit lighter versus the cost that it puts on the body to hold that light weight. So we could easily talk about that for hours, and I don't know. And that's not my area of expertise, but I just know it's part of the equation for the athlete. It's certainly been part of the learning process for my daughter. And she definitely does not fear strength training. And now she loves it, and she knows she needs it. And she's pretty darn strong pound for pound. I mean, she's lifting, you know, she can do pistols, if you know what that is, the leg extended. She can hold a 20 kilo weight and still do those pistols. So that's pretty decent.
Yeah, pistol squats. I have a problem doing those, even holding my TRX.
Yeah, so that's right. So yeah, so she's, you know, she's strong. Back in when she was a kid in school, they used to, the physical education, one of the tests was the wall sit, you know, the 90-degree wall sit.
Yep.
And one time she sat there for 32 minutes. And finally the physical education teacher said, just please stop. We have to go. So she's not opposed to strength training, trust me. But she's never going to be a big girl. She's never going to be a big muscular girl. She's just genetically not designed for that.
You've referred to sustainability several times, and I noted from another Twitter post that you'd done that there was did you create a PDF document, or did somebody else create one from a presentation you'd done called Sustainable Training for Attainable Endurance Goals?
Yeah, I did I was supposed to go to Australia, to the Gold Coast, and speak in an event hosted by Brad Beer, this physio. I'm forgetting his name of his company, but he does a wonderful job. He has his own podcast as well, Pogo Physio, and the Physical Performance Show. Anyway, so we said, well, I'm not going to be able to go to the Gold Coast. Maybe we could do something else. And we ended up, he put together a webinar, and it was a 3-hour event. And I created 4 documents, essentials of training intensity distribution, essentials of interval training, essentials of periodization, and essentials of training monitoring to support that webinar. So that was documentation that was sent out to these 300 and some odd participants. So that's where that all came from, or at least those PDFs.
Okay. Well, I might get in touch with Brad then and ask him about sharing that, and obviously, so we don't want to spoil it too much, but can you summarize in a nutshell what that exactly means for our listeners, sustainable training for attainable endurance goals?
Well, you know, I don't want to get all wrapped up in this word that's overused, sustainability, but the reality is that it is relevant, that our success as athletes is not based on the epic workouts we do, but it's based on the continuity that we demonstrate, that we have consistent training, that we stay healthy. When you look at successful endurance athletes or any successful athlete, they'll tell you, you know, here's where I had great success. I stayed injury free. I had a 1 year period where just every workout I was able to do, and that's when I hit my PBs. That's when I had great success. So that's this issue of being able to stay healthy. You know, you're going to do, if you're an elite performer, you're going to maybe do 600 training sessions in a year. You know, so it's not the one epic session or the two that they're decisive. It's what's the overall quality and quantity of training that you're able to do in a healthy way, tolerate it, absorb it, adapt to it. That's the big picture. And so when you get up in the helicopter and you see training as hundreds of stimuli per year, then you think, well, how do I get the most out of those hundreds of stimuli? Well, it's the small adjustments that you make that improve your recovery, that maybe you take a little bit off that high intensity session because it allows you to train well the next 2 days. And you add up all those small adjustments, you've created a set of, you know, a training year of 300 sessions or whatever it might be for the age grouper that was just better. It was more effective. There was better continuity. There was better consistency. And those personal bests happen when that consistency is there. So it's not sexy, but sustainable training for attainable goals means that the sustainability is present, that there are few periods of injury, few periods of sickness, few periods of stagnation, but there are nice, you're stacking lots of workouts on top of each other. And even those workouts seem ordinary, they add up to, for the athlete, potentially an extraordinary result, meaning a personal best or whatever is extraordinary for them. So out of the ordinary can come the extraordinary when we keep it healthy, keep it sustainable.
This reminds me of the presentation that you did in Manchester at the Endurance Coaching Summit, and which we talked about in the first podcast, which is your hierarchy of endurance needs. Number one, at the very bottom, the foundation is frequency and volume. And once you've achieved that and you've put together those 300, 600 sessions a year, then think about adding some intervals in. And if you're doing that on a regular basis, then think about maybe formalizing those intervals. And those first three steps will get you a long way towards your goals.
Yeah, that's right. at the risk of making myself redundant, I haven't managed to do it. I've tried, but because I keep saying basically the same things, you know, I do try to refresh myself and learn, but the basics are the same, and that hierarchy still encapsulates most of what I understand about the process. And when it just turns out that when we do those basic things really well, that eliminates a lot of the errors, the you know, false starts and so forth that tend to happen.
You were pretty active on Twitter during lockdown, Stephen, and you were asking some of your Twitter followers to help you with some online experiments that you were conducting and get the gathering of data. I wanted to ask you if you can talk about a few of those that stick in your mind, and also maybe share with what you were expecting to see from those, what you did see, and what were there any surprises?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a kind of a longer story, but part of the background for this is, of course, that in this digital age, most athletes are collecting some data on themselves essentially every workout. You know, if you're a cyclist or a triathlete, you're almost certainly measuring watts at least several times a week, sometimes every workout. You're measuring your power output. You're often measuring heart rate. So we have this digital footprint from our training sessions that, you know, we don't have to go very far back. 10 years ago or so was just not there. 10, 15 years ago, it was very unusual and certainly not in a very digitally accessible way. But now, you know, every workout I do on Zwift, I can download and so forth. So I just said, well, when you combine that development with the extra issue of the lockdown, I've got a whole bunch of cyclists that are riding indoors. It's almost like a little laboratory. Why don't I see if I can utilize this opportunity, make lemonade out of lemons, you might say. And so one of the experiments that we did, I looked at some interval sessions. For example, I created this hybrid workout that was both a two steady state intervals of 9.5 minutes in duration, and then two of these 30-15 blocks, the so-called Runnestad intervals, some people call them, and just looking at how people solve that equation if you prescribe, this hybrid session. And then, we kept developing some software we were working on and some workflow on this, on crowdsourced research. And then I put together a study where I said, hey, I need people to do 4-hour low intensity rides. And then on one day, I want you to do a 4-hour, green zone session. And then on another day, I want you to do 2 times 2 hours at that same power output that you did the 4-hour session at. Usually it was about a week apart. And so I got 46 people did that 4-hour sessions, on their bike, and I gave them a 60 to 65% of their 60-minute FTP is kind of where they wanted to be. So, we couldn't measure blood lactate. We couldn't bring them into a lab. So we had to find some kind of surrogate estimates to make sure they were in the green zone or in that first, below that first lactate turn point. And then I was interested in seeing, okay, what happens with heart rate? What happens with perceived exertion? Because they measured RPE every 20 minutes. I created some digital forms for them to fill out and all this. So we just created this crowdsourced workflow. And it was interesting because then, these are people that are either cyclists or triathletes. They are used to some pretty long training. Their average training loads were typically like 12 hours a week, as I recall, 11, 12 hours a week. So they were training pretty solid. And those 4-hour rides, I broke it up into three groups based on the cardiac drift, based on that uncoupling, as they call it, the change in the internal workload as measured with kind of a very carefully calibrated heart rate response versus the external workload, which was calibrated against their 6-minute power. So I used heart rate reserve and 6-minute power as calibration points. And then we looked at how that uncoupling unfolds over 4 hours and then tried to relate that to their perceived exertion. And so long story short, what you see is that, there were some of these athletes that basically were unaffected by 4 hours of riding, and their perceived exertion stays pretty low. Their heart rate drift is very low, very little uncoupling. And then there's a moderate group, and then there was a high uncoupling group, So there were some of these people that their perceived exertion hit 17, 18, which is pretty high on the Borg scale at the end, even though they're at 75, 70, 80% of heart rate max. So they're not working hard, but their heart rate's drifting up. And if the heart rate's drifting up, so is perceived exertion. And so for some of them, a 4-hour ride was, they really broke down, and they did, they had a lot of cardiac drift, and it wasn't accounted for by dehydration because there was, we controlled for that, and their body weight loss was the same. So you see variation, and this, I was trying to get at something that I've just called durability, that we do a lot of this low intensity training, but we haven't done very much research about what's going on in the body during these longer low intensity sessions, because they're not truly steady state. We always talk about, well, you're in a steady state, you're steady, Well, yeah, not really. Even in these low intensity rides, you are slowly deteriorating. And part of the training process, part of the adaptation that occurs with that training volume we talked about, is that our athletes get more durable. They just handle frequency of training and volume of training better, and they handle the duration of a 90-minute run or a 3-hour or 4-hour cycling ride, they just handle it better. They're less stressed, less strained by the third, fourth hour than they are earlier in their training development.
Steve, can I just jump in there a second then?
Yeah.
Were you able to correlate whether those people who were able to handle the 4 hours better and didn't show the cardiac drift, were you able to correlate that with their years of cycling? And so whether this is down to hours accumulated and just a much better mechanical efficiency?
The low drift people did tend to just be higher performers, but it wasn't immediately. I can't say it was just a clear correlation with volume. So there is a bit of a self-selection going on, I think, in the sense that you just have some athletes that have probably a higher slow twitch composition, and they're more diesel motor types that just tolerate these sessions better. So there's some of that you have to try to tease away from the training part. And that makes it a bit complicated. And that's probably why, you know, we probably need more than 46 to really get at this. But, you know, take a guy like me, I know that I have a fairly high fast twitch fiber distribution based on biopsies from when I was younger. And so I'm not the most durable guy. I'm not the person who does really well in 6-hour rides. I'm the one that breaks down. I do better in a 1-hour criterium with my body composition. So those are some issues that are baked in here. But what we did see is that it tended to correlate that the high performers, you know, they have this durability and they had less perceived exertion shift. So, you know, one of the questions that has emerged is on cardiac drift during low intensity sessions. Some people will say, well, it happens, but it's not important. It's not, you know, it's kind of a, it doesn't need to be something we worry too much about. And I get the feeling that that's not really true, is that the heart rate we see is a nice surrogate for central recruitment, for how much of the body's capacity or how much of the muscle capacity is the brain having to recruit to achieve the intended power. And so it does heart rate, relatively speaking, does tell us something about the stress of the system over time. And this is important because even those green zone sessions where I, the coach, prescribe the long run to my daughter, I don't want her heart rate to drift up too much. I don't want her to end up with a big cortisol response, where that low intensity session takes on the stress signature of a high intensity session, if that makes sense.
So in terms of dividing sessions up then, and this is something that Dan Plews has talked about, and he references what happens to the hormonal signaling, is that you can stimulate the body in the morning with a session and then go back to it 5 to 6 hours later, and the muscles and that hormonal system are then more receptive if you do another session. So for certain types of people, it might be that breaking those sessions up, for instance, a double run day, instead of doing one long run of 2 hours, it might be better for certain people to do 2 1-hour runs to get the same effect without the fatigue that's caused by that sort of cardiac drift you talk about.
Right. And that's the second part of this study was, again, we had those people who did the 4-hour ride. We also had them do 2 2-hour rides. So exactly what you say, we broke up that 4-hour ride into a 2-hour ride and then a 6-hour recovery and then another 2-hour ride. And very consistent. It was 6 hours recovery. The morning ride started basically about 8 o'clock in the morning and then finished it at either noon or 10. If it was a 2-hour ride, it finished at 10, and then they were ready to go again at 4 in the afternoon for another 2-hour ride. Well, when you do that, you decrease the overall you might call uncoupling. So they've done the same amount of work, two times two or four, at the same power output, but now there's less, there's been less cardiac drift and there's been less perceived exertion drift. Okay. So it exactly correlates with that idea. Now that we at least in theory are getting about the same amount of signal for much less stress. But I would say that probably there is something that happens in terms of signal when you do all the hours strung together that maybe you don't get when you break them up into pieces. However, I don't suspect that it's twice as good, if that makes sense. I think it's a trade-off again, and you have to look at how the athlete responds. Sometimes I think the athlete needs those long runs, or if it's a cyclist who races 4, 5, 6 hour races, then they need to do 4, 5, 6 hour training rides sometimes, not necessarily every day, but that needs to be part of their adaptation process because that's what their competitions demand. So yeah, this is one of these areas of research where we, at least the sports science types, have not done much work on this. We just really haven't spent a lot of time as a group studying that 80% of the training that endurance athletes do, which is that, you know, just do the work, low intensity, green zone training. We don't know enough about splitting workouts and how that affects hormonal responses. We have some research on it, but we don't have very much. So this is an area, I think, that is ripe for more research. The problem is, it's just not very sexy, and it's also time consuming to have people come into labs and run for 2 hours or ride for 4 hours, you know. So, but that's where we're at, and that's one of the areas I'll be working on. And I think that's one of the areas where crowdsourced research, you know, where we do this kind of at a distance approach, it's where it can help fill in the gaps, because it's easier to recruit people if they can sit in their own pain caves and collect the data.
It always seems to me when I've been involved in research projects running at the university here in Leeds, that in order for the research to be credible and be accepted and published in the sort of the relevant peer-reviewed journals, that you have to have some very stringent controls. And it felt like when you're doing crowdsource research that somebody could question whether there were those controls. And so that would then cause questions about the validity of the data you're collecting. Have you found that to be the case? Or do you actually think there is a future for the crowdsourced data and to be able to get that published?
Well, that's where we are now. And actually I have some editorial capacity also in, for example, in Frontiers. And I suggested to them that this is a topic of interest right now, that we should be looking at, you know, crowdsourced data. And there's lots of different types of crowdsourced data, you know, big databases and so forth that can contribute to informing us about the training process. But I don't think they're going to make the lab studies obsolete. Don't misunderstand me. But I think they can with the lab study, we have good internal validity. We have very tight control, but sometimes we lose external validity. We lose translation ability, if to make up a word. The transfer from lab to practical setting becomes difficult because we've had to constrain and control so much that the real world realities are forgotten. So we can design really good lab studies to look at things very mechanistically. And then just as we do in medical research, we need translation research. And we can use, I think, crowdsourced approaches, either by interrogating data from some of these big databases, you know, the calendar databases like Training Peaks or Trainer Road or, you know, whatever it might be, or using little bits, kind of hybrid studies like I design that are kind of lab-ish, in the sense that we do try to control a lot of things as best we can, but accepting that there are some issues we can't control, like the temperature in the room exactly, or the humidity on the day, or that the rider actually did not eat or, you know, didn't drink a cup of coffee before, and all these things. So we do give up some control, but what do we gain? We gain real world transferability, and we can gain sample size, because, you know, I can potentially recruit 100 cyclists to do a protocol via my Twitter account. I can't get 100 cyclists in the lab. So, you know, I think these are going to be complementary tools in the toolbox down the road.
My next question was, obviously you've been doing this polarized training research for a while now. When was the last time that you learned something that completely shifted your thinking? Or do you think you've covered all that now and it's really just confirmation of what you know?
Oh, well, you know, completely shifted my thinking. I haven't really seen anything that's done that, that's made me think, oh man, everything I did here is wrong. And I've even said in some talks to students, I said, look, if, you know, you need to constantly be critical of the literature, look at it with, you know, in an unbiased way. And if you see something that doesn't make sense, you interrogate it and you experiment, and you may show that some aspects of what I say are inconsistent with your findings, or they're ultimately, you say they're wrong. You'll be the one to do that because you'll have fresher eyes. And I accept that I'm biased. However, I still, you know, like, for example, this issue of saying, you know what, we don't know enough. We know that the best athletes do a lot of low intensity volume, but we don't know so much about getting that prescription optimal, you know, optimizing that prescription. What's the interaction between duration and intensity when we're below the first lactate turn point, for example? So if you ask me, has anything really caught my eye or made me think differently? Well, that's where I'm at now. As I've said, well, I feel like I've got a pretty decent handle on some big picture intensity distribution issues. I know a bit about interval training. I know the basics, but I want to now divert my attention to that 80%, you know, because the literature is overwhelmed with research studies, let's say, on the 20% of training that athletes do, the high intensity part. And it's underrepresented, the 80%. So that's what's caught my eye. I've become more acutely self-aware, as I say, you know, all of our bias as sports scientists is we like to focus on those high intensity sessions because they're shorter, they're more fun, it's easy to get published and so forth. And you can get the athletes in to do them, especially in the winter because it's cold outside and so forth. So this is where I'm at right now, is trying to interrogate these constructs, you know, durability, high intensity, repeatability, and training that extends over time.
I'm going to use a little analogy that you gave to me in the previous podcast, Stephen, about making the cake versus eating the cake. So yeah. It seems to me that all the research has gone into eating of the cake, the sexy bit, the 20%. And now the 80% that you're talking about is, let's do some research about making the cake. You know, should we put the salt in before we put the sugar in, or should we put the sugar in before we put the salt in? How, and what about the flour? Do we put the flour in before the eggs, or do we put the eggs in first and mix them up and then put the flour in? That's the 80% about how we mix the ingredients together to form the cake before we do the decorations on the top.
Yeah, you know, I don't want to take that analogy too far, but I definitely, you know, so there's been such a misunderstanding for so long about people saying, oh yeah, that's just trash miles, or that's recovery training. And both of those terms just drive me bananas, because when you actually look at the development of elite performers, you clearly can show and see that it's neither trash nor recovery. It is fundamentally training. It's part of their developmental process. It's part of their adaptation. All of those many hours at so-called talking pace, you know, for them, that has been part of their success. So I guess we're coming to that understanding. And but if you first accept that it's not trash miles, it's not just so recovery training, then that means, well, then it is actually training. And we don't know so much about it. For example, we get asked all the time, Dr. Seiler, you tell me that I need to train a lot in the green zone, but where in the green zone? Because that green zone's pretty broad. You know, it could be all the way down to, say, 50% of max, and it may be all the way up to nearly 80% of max, of heart rate max or VO2 max, depending on your fitness. Where should I be there? Should I do 5 hours of cycling at, you know, a really low intensity, or should I do 2 hours just a few watts below that turn point? What's best? And my answer is, I don't know, because we haven't investigated that, you know. But I do say that I'm pretty sure that it is an interaction issue, that if, you know, duration and intensity combine, they interact in different ways. And so there's not one answer. I'm not going to say, well, 65%, that's the golden intensity. That's almost certainly wrong. Because you can manipulate intensity and duration and that interaction between them in different ways. And maybe depending on your event duration, your physiology and so forth, you may find that you respond to and handle different combinations of intensity and duration in that green zone better or less, you know, or worse. So these are questions we need to answer.
There's a couple of other things that spring to mind here, particularly for the people who might be listening to this conversation. Also, the type of people I coach is that many of those are age group athletes. They have other stuff going on in their lives. It's not for them. It's not solely about athletic performance. They have jobs that which probably includes travel. They have families. They have other worries. So they have stress, and so the training that they do, and you know that how that training distribution is made up will actually have a different effect on the body depending on all of the other stuff, including the type of sleep and the amount of sleep they get, their nutrition. So that's constantly changing. So it seems to me, and we've discussed it a couple of times, is that you have to have a really good sense of your body and how your body's responding to certain things. And so knowing your own body, and we talk about listening to your body, and it's something we talk about a lot, but actually I don't think a lot of people do it or do it very effectively. And you've talked about how your daughters learned to do that. The other thing is, and again, Dan Plews and Paul Larson and the other guys have talked about this as well, is the harder you push your body during training, the more sympathetic stress you create. And that then means that you need longer to recover. What happens with training in certain parts of this green zone is that you don't create that sympathetic stress. You do get a bit of an overload, but you don't create the sympathetic stress. And so it's easier to link together large blocks of training that when accumulated together have a better impact on your long-term fitness. So it's a movable feast, isn't it? And it's complex, and there are so many parts, and it's not just related to training. It's related to your lifestyle as well, and your age, I suppose.
Yeah, so I use a couple of analogies or ways of describing this. And one is that, you know, people ask me, well, how would you summarize all this 20 years? Why polarized? And it comes down to me to trying to maximize the adaptive signal at a minimum stress, a minimum systemic stress. So if you think of signal as green and stress as red, I'm trying to maximize the positive signal and at least an acceptable or tolerable stress. Not necessarily minimize it, but optimize it. And I think that's what athletes have done over the years. They've figured this out without being molecular biologists or physiologists. They've just figured it out because they say, well, you know what? I do better when I mostly train at lower intensity and sometimes train hard, and it just kind of works for me. They don't necessarily know why, but they know that it works. Well, you know, we can go in and measure hormones and so forth, and we can show that, yeah, there's a big sympathetic response. There's a big hormonal response, cortisol response to these high intensity sessions. And there's also, if you go long enough at, you know, pretty close to your first lactate turn point, green becomes yellow. And it may even feel like red by the end if you're not adapted to it. So if I am used to doing 2 hour rides on my bike and I end up going 4 hours at my typical 2 hour power, that may end up feeling darn tough for me, and it will elicit a big cortisol response. So that third and fourth hour are very different in terms of both stress and signal than the first and second hour were. Mm. So it's not just linear. You can't just say, well, I'm at this intensity factor and I just take that factor and multiply it times the number of hours. And that's unfortunate, because that doesn't really reasonably express what's going on in the body. Cause we know that fourth hour of cycling or that second hour of running is different than the first, right? It's tougher. You're fatiguing. And we can measure cortisol levels and show that you get past a certain point, the duration gets a bit long, and all of a sudden you get a spike in cortisol. So at any rate, this is, I totally agree with this issue that, you know, Dan and these guys are talking about. That's the way I look at it as well, is I'm trying to manipulate signal and stress. I'm trying to minimize stress. I'm trying to make this sustainable. And for the age grouper, like you say, that has the real job, that has the mortgage, that is dealing with kids being educated at home right now, and they're about to go bonkers, and you know they got stress coming from all directions. Hey, one thing we learned from Celia and others, you know, that some of our physiological forefathers were telling us that, look, the stress system, our evolutionary ability to handle stress, it's just one big pot. The responses, whether it's the stress of trying to solve a math puzzle, or the stress of feeling like you may lose your job, or the stress of a high intensity interval session, they trigger the same pathways. And it adds up to the same stress. And so for sure, I have total respect for the fact that the age grouper may not be a world-class athlete, but they're dealing with stress just as much. They may have just as much total stress as the elite endurance athlete who does nothing but train and has a sponsor and is basically not thinking about anything except eat, sleep, train, repeat. So there's different ways to fill up your stress box or your stress quota. And if you're an average person, you don't have, you know, some of that quota is being filled up with a lot of non-training related stuff.
Reminds me of a presentation I heard from a gentleman called Mike Stone. I don't know if you're familiar with him. Yeah. He was at the U.S. Olympic Center in Colorado Springs, I think.
I think he was at Appalachian State for many years as well.
Yeah, but he did a strength conditioning, and of course with you being a strength conditioning, having a background there, you would have come across Mike. But he did this presentation. He kept interrupting it with these phrases, you know, stress is accumulative, and then he'd talk about something else, and then stressors, and then all stressors are cumulative, going, you know, confirming what you've just said about everything goes into the same bucket. And again, I think that's a common mistake that we make as age group athletes, and relates to some of the questions that I have for you in a moment, actually, about polarized training, is that people don't think about their life stress and their training stress as being together. They think of them as totally separate, and therefore I've got X number of hours and I need to maximize that, so I'm going to go hard. And of course, unwittingly, they're creating more stress, which is actually counterproductive for them.
Absolutely.
Hey, listeners, it's been a fantastic conversation so far. I don't know if you remember back to our last conversation that we had at Christmas. Stephen and I chatted for over 2 hours. I didn't want to go on for that long this time, so what we're going to do is leave it there for this week. In next week's episode, Stephen will be answering some of the questions that the listeners have kindly sent in about polarized training. So thank you for listening so far, and I'll see you next week.
Right then, that's a wrap for this week.
thanks again for listening. As always, I appreciate that you have plenty of choice out there in podcast land, so it does mean an awful lot to me when you come back regularly. If you enjoyed the podcast, please could you hop onto iTunes or Podbean and leave a rating and a comment if you can. Apparently, it's really good for the ratings, although to be absolutely honest with you, I have no idea how they work these things out. If you like the way I roll and you find some synergy with my approach to life and sport, maybe be interested in joining my SWAT Inner Circle training group. If you are, please just email beth@thetriathloncoach.com for more details. You can also use that email address to ask for my special free gift, which I have for you, which are my top 25 tips on how to be a high-performance human. Okay, that's all for this week. I'll be back next week with another great guest. So for now, enjoy the rest of your week.